Now, work credits, as I call them, would be extremely valuable to the poverty-stricken family. And these work credits would then be available, notwithstanding the welfare payment, for the purpose of bringing about the rehabilitation of that family. Again, no budgetary impact, because this is just the retention by the individual family of earnings which it itself has, but which now result in a reduction in its relief check beyond a certain point which we have established by law, and which should not result in that reduction when the family can have a chance to redeem itself completely if it could buy certain services which it cannot buy with a relief check. Now, another great advantage of this scheme is that it would encourage a great many service lines of business in slum areas, and it would tend to equalize the relationship between the lower income wage earner and the welfare recipient. So I deeply believe that this is an idea, and I shall put it into legislation and endeavor to work it out in the Congress. This is an idea, a credit device, which can have many repercussions and can be extremely valuable. The third concept which I would like to lay before you and which I will lay before the Congress is perhaps another one which, like the idea of using welfare payments for job training in part, is bold, but I think is essential, especially interesting to our state. For I believe that we must now have federal standards for welfare payments in order to establish equitable and relatively uniform standards throughout the United States, of course, giving consideration to cost of living differences. As, for example, the example I gave you, $3,850 to a welfare family of four a year in Rochester, $4,100 in the city of New York. Now, I believe that if you did have federal standards, you would go a long way toward dealing with the migration of populations now driven from one part of the country to another by virtue of the fact that standards of welfare are debased in many states in the country in a very shameful way. Welfare goes from as little as $9 a month to as much as $90 a month in a given case, depending upon the state in which the recipient is located. So I believe we must have federal standards. This is necessary upon humanitarian grounds, and it's necessary in terms of families which move from place to place because it is just not livable in a given place if you're on welfare. Now, in establishing such standards, the federal government would probably have to pick up more of the tab for the amount between what the states are now paying and the federally established minimum payment. The major change would be to relieve the states and localities from paying as much as they do now of their present matching shares. But I would propose that this be done on condition that the states and localities take over and pay for services and remedial activities like health directed at welfare recipients, and that the federal budget be relieved of such payments in at least an equal proportion. In that way, I believe, we can move toward gradually, and I emphasize this would have to be a gradualist approach, a correct division of labor between the federal and the state and local governments. The federal government would do what it does best, namely act as a paymaster, raising and dispensing funds on a nationwide basis for the income support of the welfare system. I might point out that that's exactly what we do in respect of the unemployment compensation system. And the federal government does this very well under unemployment compensation and under Social Security. Now, some states, like New York, might like to handle even the paymaster function, and we would allow for that in the law, provided that they're able to do it, and New York is. On the other hand, outside of the paymaster function, the states and localities should be zeroed in on supportive service programs, something like health, which they're equipped to do, and which would allow us, therefore, to reduce the size of the federal bureaucracy, a major part of which is engaged in exactly those activities. Now, that's my third proposal: federal standards for welfare throughout the United States. My fourth proposal is something which has to be pursued outside the welfare system itself. In my judgment, we must raise the minimum wage in this country and the career opportunities which are available to able working people. In that way, we will widen the gap between the normal working family not on welfare and the family below the poverty level which has to be on welfare. And in this regard, also, I think we have to give special attention to problems of urban family instability. Now, there are some things that can be done about that on the federal level. Among them are a federal means by which support suits, that is, catching runaway fathers, can be carried on in different states of the United States. This is a critically important reform, in my judgment. And lastly, we must step up our efforts through education, decentralized health services, and counseling to deal with the problems of illegitimacy by making birth control information available and birth control equipment more widely available. Now, this does not go to the question of choice, which is partially a religious question. It goes only to the question of availability. And that, I think, is also seriously deficient in the United States. Now, gentlemen, I conclude as follows. The welfare problem right now, for the reasons I've given you, because we are a more humanitarian nation, and because of the anti-poverty program, we've really dug into what's at stake and what's our problem, and we're dealing with much greater numbers of welfare clients, though the total population below the poverty level is much smaller. This is a strange contradiction, a paradox, but a very valid one. And therefore, the welfare problem is threatening literally to overwhelm us. I know it's threatening to overwhelm the city of New York from the figures I gave you alone, and it's a very serious matter in every other major city in the state and in the country. And I believe that new thinking, new concepts, new ideas are absolutely essential. Some of the established ideas I've given you my views on, affidavit techniques, experimenting with a guaranteed annual income or a family allowance, as I prefer it. But new ideas, I have tried to lay a number before you. And if the people return me to the Senate, I will do my utmost to see if these new ideas can be implemented. There are tremendous potentials in not only reducing the welfare load, but indirectly, yet very directly, reducing the 20% bulge in crime and traditional crime which exists in the United States. That is homicides, assaults, robberies, breaking and entry, etc. And to measurably improve the climate in individual states and individual locales like your own, which breeds the opportunity for riots and violence in the slums of America, which is the other half of the so-called law and order problem. And I deeply believe that this is constructive, that this is what we have to do. With all respect to anyone who may disagree with me, I think the application of George Wallace's theory of segregate them and beat them over the head with a nightstick will create much more insurrection rather than less. But I think the course of action, along the lines I have laid it out, whether you take my ideas or other fresh, bright, and original, and courageous ideas on the subject, are designed to get on top of the problem, and also including great federal aid to new police techniques and better compensation for the police, and better automation in their transportation, and better electronics in their communication. Now, these are critically important. That's the way in which I'm confident our country can get on top of the problem. I'm very grateful to you for listening. I see John George is here, another candidate. If there are any other candidates for the assembly who would like to stand up, so I just might pay my respects. John, I'm very glad to see you. Gentlemen, in closing, I again wish to emphasize I've considered this a major policy statement on welfare, and I hope you will agree that I've laid before you provocative ideas which are well worth deliberation and consideration by the country and if the people will give me the opportunity, I will see that they have such deliberation and such consideration. Thank you.
I'm Ronnie Eldridge.
I'm E.G. Marshall.
I'm Julian Bond.
I'm Father Ray Schroeder.
I'm Hal Holbrook.
I'm Colleen Dewhurst.
And I'm Ramsey Clark, here with some of my friends who've come to lend a hand. I've never run for elective office before. Spent 8 years in the Department of Justice back in the 60s, three with President John F. Kennedy, and remainder in the administration of Lyndon Johnson. I'm a private person. It's not exactly my style, perhaps, but I couldn't stand not to be involved now. You see, I think our country's in deep trouble. I really do. And I think each of us has to try to do something about it. You know, when I look around and see how we ration health, little children and older people in this society needing medical services and health care and not getting it. And I see millions of families living in inadequate housing, and so many having to pay rents they can't afford. And I look at the breakdown of our transportation system and or non-system and see the Congress spending $70 billion these last 18 years for highways, and not even 1% of that hardly for public transportation. And I see the constant peril of war in so many parts of the earth, and the United States not playing the role of peacemaker that is, I think, our destiny in history, because we're the nation that includes all the peoples of earth. I have to try to do something. Well, I'm worried about the political process itself. I don't think we've been practicing democracy. I think we need to register all of our folks. Don't ask them how they're going to vote, only that they vote, as if their country depended on it. I think we need to liberate the political process from the domination of wealth. I think we've permitted money, special interests to dominate politics and through politics government. When you look at the millions flowing through Watergate, and there is a Watergate, to the shame of this country. When you see all those millions flowing through there, you know it's nothing but special interest having its way. That's why I'm running a campaign in a special way. Nobody can give more than $100 to this campaign. That means my campaign can go as far as you want it to go, and no further. Harry, I think that's as far as any campaign ought to go.
Well, Ramsey, I agree with you. And after having been involved for so long in so many campaigns, this was the first time in many years that I found an opportunity to truly have an option as a citizen, as a concerned citizen. I think each and every one of you should really realize that and really feel it. Because for just $10, you can help make the change that's necessary. You can't give any more than 100. Ramsey laid that down as the line. Even if you wanted to, you couldn't. You can give more than one person in the family. But no individual can give more than that. And the reason for that is that all of us can now have an option in government. And if you do not exercise that option, then the oil companies will continue to exercise that option. The Con Edisons of the world will continue to exercise that option. It's up to us. Let us get our government back. Let it be a people's government. Let us get men in office like Ramsey Clark. And all it costs you is $10. Try it.
Ramsey, Senator Javits, true to his own convictions, accepted a $15,000 campaign contribution from Nelson Rockefeller. I wonder, considering Rockefeller's role today, what you think of that and how you find such contributions.
Well, what I was hoping was that Jules Feiffer or somebody would draw one of those cartoons that just tells the whole truth, you know, in a few lines. Maybe I'm old-fashioned. When I first heard that Senator Javits had accepted $15,000 from Nelson Rockefeller while there was pending before him as a United States senator the matter of the nomination of that very person, Nelson Rockefeller, to be the Vice President of the United States, I could not believe it. That has to be the clearest breach of any moral canon. It has to be the clearest sort of conflict of interest. How can the person who must sit in judgment at the very time the case is before him accept from the person he must judge $15,000? That is so insensitive as to be disqualifying and profoundly question the judgment of all involved, at the very least.
Mr. Clark,
the Democratic Party, as I look at it, seems to be full of people who are pretty much committed to supporting the status quo. Look, you got Senator Eastland of Mississippi, and even when they claim to upset the status quo, like George Wallace, it doesn't really change it in the kind of fundamental way that it seems to me it has to be changed. What hope do you see for the Democratic Party?
Well, I see a lot of hope, Mr. Seeger. Maybe one of my prejudices. It's not so much the party, really, as the system that gives all that power to a James O. Eastland. You know, I find it hurting in here to know that the Senate of the United States, through a seniority system that Jacob Javits is a very major and real part of, gives that power to someone who so alien to so much of the aspiration of this society. But if you look around at the Democratic Party, it's got some people like Julian Bond. I call that real democracy. It is the party of the people. It's got here in New York State a Hugh Carey. I'm excited about his candidacy. I think it's the best chance this state has had in a long, long time to get on the road again toward becoming a just society. Got a woman running for Lieutenant Governor, Marianne Kripsack. What a magnificent human being. What a moral force. I believe in moral forces. It may be old-fashioned. I think she's won. I don't say the Democratic Party is perfect by any means. I guess I voted for lots of Republicans and independents, and I guess I will again. I think you have to judge on the merits, but I think the Democratic Party offers more hope right now for change, for real change, than anything on the scene.
Ramsey, another squeeze as a consumer. I go marketing for the family once a week, and I get so depressed, and then I get very angry because I think my food bills have gone up $20 or $30 a week, and I'm buying the cheapest of everything. But more than that, I mean, I realize I'm a consumer, and this is my front-to-front confrontation with inflation, and all those other people in the supermarket, some of them old and really putting the food back on the counter, are consumers. And I don't think anybody's really talking to us or protecting our rights or talking up. I think we get intimidated by the economists, and then we have the president tell us about a surcharge on our income tax if we're over what I consider a very moderate means. But do you really think you could do something about that, and what can somebody in the Senate do about it?
Well, of course we can, Ronnie, and I don't think we have more important piece of business. You remember Richard Nixon and John Mitchell and those others said I was soft on crime back in 68. In fact, President Nixon said the first thing that he was going to do to restore order and respect for law was get a new attorney general, and he got John Mitchell. that's because I don't favor wiretapping. I don't favor the death penalty. I don't think we're a killer nation. I think we can do better than that. I think inflation's a crime. I think a country that sits around and watches the oil industry exploit the so-called energy crisis last winter, as we did, its profits skyrocketing and our gasoline and oil prices skyrocketing and does nothing, has lost its political will. I don't think that's the United States of America. I believe that we need comprehensive, sensitive, effective price and wage controls. I don't like it any more than I like to take bad taste in medicine when I'm sick. But look, food prices have gone up 23% in the last year. and lots of tables that don't have enough food for the people that are crowded around it, and that's not my idea of America. And I think we need to have the power and the will to roll prices back. I think we need to have the power and the will to tax excess profits. We've done that in the past. Franklin Roosevelt brought us through a depression by doing that. The inflationary pressures in World War II and the Korean War were far greater than anything we have now. And we had some leadership that stood up and said, we're going to do it. Look, this is a free country, and we have courage and we have will. And we had price and wage control. We can put that on, and we can keep it on until we stop this inflation. That's the way to stop inflation. I think we need to produce more food. We've got to go out and stimulate food production. We're still paying rich farmers billions annually not to grow more food and fiber, while on those very farms, often, we were talking about Senator Easton a few minutes ago, his plantation in Sunflower County, Mississippi. I remember, Julian, when I sent the federal examiners down there to register voters in Sunflower County, they said, you can't do that. That's Senator Easton's county. I said, well, I thought that was the people's county. We're going to do it, and we did it, and we started registering folks in Sunflower County, too. But if we will face up to these things and act and start producing food rather than paying rich farmers billions annually, like Senator Easton, who was getting $100,000 plus a year not to grow food on his plantation, as he called it, while little children were suffering malnutrition. We've got millions suffering malnutrition. We've got to start producing food. That's the only way I know to get food prices down, and we can do it.
Ramsey, the daycare centers have made it possible for those mothers who want and are able to work to have, as Martin can use to say, a sense of somebodyness, to feel like a person, to be a person. They are now in great trouble and in danger of being closed. What do you think can be done to preserve and guarantee their programs continuing? Because, as you know, if they don't, the mothers have no alternative but to resort to welfare.
Well, Marion, as you recall, the fight a few years back that was led so ably by Marion Wright Edelman in the Congress, yes, and you and I were trying to help, we're going to have to get a Congress that cares about children, that knows what it means when working mothers have to leave children without anybody to take care of them, what it means to the total society, not just the child and that family. The federal government is going to have to provide the funding that will provide the opportunity for every parent who works and has minor children to leave them in a place that is clean and wholesome and will provide some education and some contact with other children. And then we can get this going again. It is a matter of commitment, and we need to have a universal opportunity for child care for all the children that need somebody to take care of them while the folks are away.
I'd like to just make an observation, if I could, once again at this point, and that is that the very few words that you've heard just now are... I always feel like a vulgarian whenever I have to talk about money. There seems to be something just totally insidious about all of man and all of history that's ever created this thing called money. But in reality, it is impossible to move in this society without it. I think the only thing that we can do is to determine what we do with it, and that's a moral issue, and an issue of ethics. And for those of us who have felt so hopeless and defenseless and all that's been going on, we really and truly, if we thought about it, would understand that we can do something. And if we want to change it all, we can make it happen. And you can make it happen by sending to Ramsey Clark from the U.S. Senate campaign $10, $15, $20. Sorry, I just had to put that in.
Somebody's going to do the commercial sooner or later.
Mr. Clark, I heard Senator Javits point with pride to his successful enactment of the pension reform bill. He said it's the greatest step forward since Social Security. I've discovered that 80% of the people in this country, the working people in this country, will not be covered by that pension reform bill. Would you respond to that?
We've had the politics of caution in this country for a long time. We have a Senate that is almost paralyzed. I don't like to say that because I love the Senate and the Congress. I first walked onto the floor of the House of Representatives as a 9-year-old kid. I want to believe that place can aggressively enact laws this country needs. But we've lost moral leadership and force there. First, we desperately need Social Security reform. It reaches all of our people in their later years, and it is terribly inadequate. Second, when we approach something of great importance, like pension reform, we need to approach it aggressively, saying we can enact good laws that protect people and provide solutions to problems. You know, the Pension Reform Act that Senator Javits is so proud of, and it's better than what we had before, but it passed the Senate without a dissenting vote. Now, what kind of compromise is that? How much did you give up that you could have gotten? Why don't we have some fighters in there that say, we want better laws, we need better laws, we're going to make this a just society and work for it? And the pension reform law that we have leaves more to be done than it did, and that's not good enough.
Ramsey, like Mr. Marshall, I'm for your candidacy for a lot of different reasons, but one of them is that, in my view, you were the last attorney general the country really had, and one of the hallmarks of your term there was a concern about voting rights and the rights and black people in the southern part of this country, and it's because of your effort, I think, that there are now proportionately more blacks registered to vote in Selma, Alabama, than there are in Brooklyn, New York. But one question that has bothered me about a lot of people who served in the Senate who call themselves liberals is the whole question of federal judgeships in the South. We've now got men like Harold Cox of Mississippi, who Senator Eastland's name keeps coming up. He was Senator Eastland's roommate at law school at Ole Miss. Once he got on the bench, he called black voting rights applicants orangutans and said the NAACP stood for niggers, alligators, apes, possums, and coons. Now, when this man's name came up before the Senate, your opponent, Senator Javits, because of the rule of senatorial courtesy, didn't say a word, just let it go on through. And now he sits in judgment on the lives of black people in, the Northern District of Mississippi. What can be done to change that kind of system that allows these horrendous people to achieve such positions of power?
Well, I think it's something we know how to do. We kid ourselves. We say things aren't possible. I was attorney general for, about 2 years and 4 months, I guess. I sent up to the White House as the attorney general hundreds and hundreds of judicial nominations. We filled nearly 45% of all the judgeships in the federal judiciary while I was attorney general. Not a single name was ever sent forward that wasn't rated qualified, that wasn't carefully scrutinized for any racial prejudice or other bias in personal life and background. Now, Senator Javits has said publicly that he has recommended more than 50 persons rated unqualified for the judiciary. That is absolutely unacceptable. I think not only that thou shalt not ration justice, thou also shalt not tamper with it by ever suggesting to the judiciary any person not qualified.
Ramsey, Paul O'Dwyer, president of the city council, just came in. We have another member of the clergy who just came in, a friend of ours, Rabbi Brickner.
Another member. I didn't know Paul was a member of the clergy.
Welcome to the club. On the way back, Rabbi.
Oh, but you're sitting next to a Catholic priest.
Oh, well, they fool you all the time. They say you don't look like a priest. Ramsey, as I travel around the Jewish community, and I do that a little bit, the first question that they ask me is, how is it possible for that fella Clark to be supportive of military aid for Israel, which they appreciate, and which all of us appreciate in the Jewish community, and at the same time have taken such a strong position in the anti-war movement in during Vietnam days?
You know, it's a little sad for me to see people ask why there seems to be this difference in approach between Indochina and the Middle East. Can we see no difference between Israel and South Vietnam?
Unfortunately, a lot of people can't.
Israel represents democracy and freedom, and to me, the human spirit. I don't see how decent people anywhere could stand it if anything happened to Israel. It's surrounded with the potential for violence. South Vietnam, we supported tyranny there, in my judgment. We interceded foolishly in a civil war, in a conflict that had been going on for years and years before we entered, and that we could not resolve. I think we have a moral obligation to civilization, to human destiny, to assure Israel without any ambiguity that it will have all of the material it needs from the United States to defend itself, to survive. But I must say that if that's all we did, how tragically inadequate our commitment would be. You can't go on living every moment of your life wondering if the next war is to begin then. People have to have hope. And that's why I've gone far beyond that into a plan that first I think is essential for so many other reasons, an energy policy here in the United States that will liberate this country from fossil fuels, if you will. We're going to invest whatever it takes to learn how to use solar energy, to find ways for carrying hydrogen, which can be a good fuel. When you combust hydrogen, the exhaust is water vapor. That's not so bad for you as this other stuff we've got floating all around our cities and causing our people to die young, and that's not necessary. I think we can create that energy policy. I think we must. I think the pressure from the Arab-rich oil nations, the blackmail and extortion that is possible there until we manifest clearly that commitment and get moving on it is potentially disastrous for survival on this planet.
Do I understand then you mean that the Israel question and the energy question are kind of linked? Because, I mean, if we help Israel, we incur the wrath of the oil-producing companies, so to speak, or tip the scales, and then we're further in need and we can be blackmailed. Is that... That does kind of go together, doesn't it?
A little bit, yeah. It's only part of it, though, I think. Well, when I look back, I saw the United States of America, the land I love, and I feel an obligation to constantly work to make this a more just society, confronted with a choice between chrome and humanity in Rhodesia. We wanted the chrome badly. We're the only nation on earth to defy the United Nations Security Council ban and purchase chrome. The choice came, chrome, humanity, we chose chrome. Very similar situation in Chile. The choice was between humanity and copper. And we chose copper. I do not want to see this United States ever permit a dependency here to grow on Middle East oil. It will cause us to have to choose someday in the Middle East between oil and humanity.
You know, Mr. Clark, I was going to ask something, but I've forgotten it now. Because I've been listening to you talk to everybody, and everything that I've always felt about you is coming from you. And yet when I say that I want Mr. Clark to summon, the response often is, oh yes, superhuman being. Wonderful philosophy, little way out, but don't dream, though. I want to know what you would like me to say to them in terms of a basis as to whether this is a dream we keep dreaming, looking for that voice in the wilderness or somebody somewhere.
Well, two things, I guess. First, look where we are with what we have. Is this your idea of the best America can do? Your hard-headed, practical politicians with all their pragmatism. Look how we risk war all over the world. Look how we support tyranny in so many foreign countries. Look how we ration health here and deprive young children of their chance for fulfillment in an equal and decent education.